showed up in extremis, tachypneic, tachycardic, diaphoretic, using accessory muscles, and had significant rowels on her physical exam.
What's the right dose of nitroglycerin? And my answer is yes. Your dosing will make an impact on what outcome you're going to get, but so will your patient's pathophysiology. Look at the patient in front of you.
Okay, that's helpful. Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland. And joining me this podcast, a special guest, a new voice here to CCPEM, and that is none other than Jill Logan, ED pharmacist extraordinaire at the University of Maryland Department of Emergency Medicine. Jill, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mike.
I am so happy to get you on, and it comes on the heels of something that we just worked on from a clinical standpoint, and that is a clinical protocol using high-dose nitroglycerin or bolus dose nitroglycerin, in essence, for our emergency department patients coming in with acute pulmonary edema. There's been a lot of discussion lately, whether it be social media, blog posts, a few articles have come out in the recent 1 to 2 years discussing this use of high-dose or bolus-dose nitroglycerin, and it's something we began to see in our emergency department. So Jill specifically took a look or delved into the evidence and then put together an outstanding clinical protocol that we've just implemented. And to that end, Jill, before we get started, just since you're joining us here on the podcast for the first time, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a proud UConn graduate, the University of Connecticut for pharmacy school. After that, I did a first-year residency in Virginia and then a second-year residency specializing in critical care in Boston at Boston Medical Center. They made the mistake of letting me work in the emergency department, and so I never went back to the ICU since I finished my critical care residency. And I've been working in emergency medicine ever since in the Baltimore area, recently before here at Baltimore Washington Medical Center, and now here with you.
It's been almost a year, I think, hasn't it?
It has been. It's been a very fast year.
Well, you have done a tremendous amount of great things in our ED for our patients. Clearly, they have benefited from your expertise, and they may not even know that you're behind the scenes, but we all do. From a clinical standpoint, our nurses, physicians, residents all love working with you. So welcome aboard, and then welcome to the podcast. I think our listeners are going to really enjoy this discussion.
You're too kind. Thank you very much.
All right. So what I wanted to lead us into this discussion on, I worked the overnight shifts this past weekend in the emergency department. And Saturday morning, so early Saturday morning, I should say, there was a lady who came in, box call or EMS base station call. This was around 5:30-ish. So clearly she had either been up all night or was just getting up. And the call was for respiratory distress. She was a 60-ish year old female, had a history of hypertension, diabetes, CHF with reduced ejection fraction. So it was on the order of about 30 to 35%. Had an AICD, all the typical cardiac things, who had awoken, acute shortness of breath, called EMS, and she was in significant to severe distress. They tried to apply CPAP en route along with giving her sublingual nitroglycerin, but she really wasn't tolerating non-invasive ventilation. And she showed up in extremis, tachypneic, tachycardic, diaphoretic, using accessory muscles, and had significant rowels on her physical exam, certainly looking like acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So we were headed down the nitroglycerin route, preload reduction, and I think pretty much all of our listeners are on board. Yes, use nitroglycerin, use it early. But what we want to focus on in terms of this discussion for this particular patient is, what about the dose? So Jill, kind of take it away. Let's get started in terms of talking about nitroglycerin with respect to pulmonary edema.
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been asked many times over the past few months, what's the right dose of nitroglycerin? And my answer is yes. Whatever dose you tell me, that's probably the right dose. Nitroglycerin is okay as low as 5 mics a minute. It's been studied up to 2 milligrams or 2,000 micrograms IV push. And really, you want to base your dosing on the patient in front of you. Because there's such a large dosage range, it really behooves us to know what dose is appropriate for what patient. Thinking about a patient that you described, it makes sense to go a little bit higher on the dosing range. Higher doses of nitroglycerin will reduce preload and afterload, as we know, but we know it from some pretty benign data in healthy volunteers getting sublingual nitroglycerin. So there's one study that looks at patients getting sublingual nitroglycerin and getting blood levels of nitroglycerin over time. And we can see at the higher doses of nitroglycerin, like the lower doses of nitroglycerin in their blood, there's no difference in preload reduction. These patients are going to be preload reduced. However, at the higher concentrations of nitroglycerin in their blood, there is significantly more afterload reduction than there is at lower concentrations in their blood. We've all heard there's higher doses are required for afterload reduction. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's based on these healthy volunteers, so it's hard to say what exactly is going to cause that same afterload reduction in the patient that you just described coming in at 5 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday.
So that's pretty interesting to hear that a lot of the literature on a standard practice for this particular patient is not based on a lot of sick patients, but the effects in healthy folks.
At least from what I've been able to find, and a lot of this data is from the 70s and 80s, so not all of it is easily accessible, but from what I've been able to see, that's been the basis of this information. There are some studies that are smaller that are done in patients with actual pathophysiology. There's one study that looks at patients that have a normal healthy heart and normal blood pressure, and they compared those to patients that had high systemic vascular resistance, then compared that to patients that had low ejection fraction. And these three groups all received nitroglycerin 200 micrograms or 400 micrograms in the patients with CHF. And what they were able to show is that all patients had a reduction in blood pressure, but those patients with normal pathophysiology had more of a preload reduction. Patients with the pathophysiology of heart failure or hypertension had more afterload reduction, which is really interesting because your dosing will make an impact on what outcome you're going to get, but so will your patient's pathophysiology. So that's really kind of neat to a pharmacist.
Okay. Well, so that's kind of the baseline studies. I know recently when we've talked about this in terms of putting the protocol together, what are some more recent studies looking at this concept of high-dose nitroglycerin?
When you say recent, I think you mean the 90s.
Relatively recent.
So the best study, in my personal opinion, is the study by Cotter that looked at high-dose nitrates with a lower dose of furosemide versus high-dose furosemide with a lower dose of nitrates. And they were kind of told by the IRB they had to have both of these treatments in their both arms because they were both considered standard of care. And so they unfortunately didn't get to do the trial that they ultimately wanted to do, but it was still a pretty well-done study with relatively sick patients. The respiratory rate in these patients when they came in were in the mid-30s to 40s, so they were pretty sick. They were similar to the patient that you described at the beginning of this podcast. And what they did was they gave the patients either the high-dose nitrates or the high-dose furosemide and then almost homeopathic or standard dosing of the other agents. So they really weren't measuring their effect. They were just giving them there for the baseline. And when they were able to show that the patients with the higher-dose nitrates had a lower rate of intubation and lower rate of adverse cardiac effects. So I think really speaks to the benefit of giving high-dose nitrates, but it may also speak to the benefit of delaying your furosemide therapy in these patients that show up. As we know, patients that are coming in pulmonary edema are oftentimes euvolemic or hypovolemic, and then giving them furosemide, it does work once they start perfusing their kidneys, but it may be a little counterproductive in the patient and extremis just because we're activating the RAS system, increasing the afterload that the heart needs to work against. So I think that this study shows us that maybe high-dose nitrates are helpful, and maybe high-dose furosemide is not the best therapy at the very beginning. Obviously, as we stabilize the patient, giving them a loop diuretic will be helpful if they are volume overloaded.
Okay, and then the same institution, didn't they have a follow-up study or similar to that?
Sure. So the Cotter study did the isosorbide dinitrate, and that was the European study. They used, I believe it was 3 milligram doses of that drug, and in my best guess, that's about 200 micrograms of nitroglycerin.
Okay, that's helpful.
Here in the United States, in Detroit, Levy did a study looking at high dose, the 2 milligram dose nitroglycerin IV push in patient population that you described earlier, and they compared that to a convenient sample of patients who weren't enrolled. And these patients were, again, pretty sick, and they were able to show a decreased rate of intubations, but that was not statistically significant. The most recent study that I think is bringing this back up is by Wilson and colleagues, and they looked at that same institution in downtown Detroit and looked at what has the impact of this practice change, what has happened since then. And so they looked at the patients that received these 2 milligram doses of nitroglycerin, and since the study had happened, the average number of doses had decreased from 3 to 1 in most patients. But they were able to show that less patients in the IV bolus group required hospital admission at a higher level of care. This may have been slightly skewed because their requirement for ICU admission was a vasoactive drip as well. Mm-hmm. So if their comparison group was patients who didn't get the bolus, they obviously got the drip. Mm-hmm. And so they may have been in the ICU longer because of the infusion requirement versus the bolus requirement. It's hard to say what the clinical outcome was of the drip versus the bolus. Mm-hmm. However, I think that there's a lot of good safety data, both from the Levy and the Wilson study, that doses as high as 2,000 micrograms are probably safe. There was a very low risk of adverse effects.
I think that's probably going to be surprising to many who are listening, who are used to getting nitroglycerin infusions started, but often starting at 20 or 30 micrograms. And more we're seeing practitioners start at higher doses, 50, 80, 100, maybe even 200 mics. But to actually give two milligrams of nitroglycerin is probably going to raise a lot of eyebrows and concerns, and having a lot of nurses look at you as well. So in terms of the evidence, let's kind of get back to my lady who came in extremis, mm-hmm. definite pulmonary edema. We had ultrasound in there, took a quick look. She had B-lines all over her lung fields, confirming exactly, you know, what we anticipated. Sure, her x-ray showed pulmonary edema, but right off the bat, she's in extremis. We're going to look to implement non-invasive ventilation. We're going to look to implement nitroglycerin or nitrate therapy. And then the standard things that we would do for pulmonary edema. But specifically regarding the initiation of the infusion, because there is such a wide dosing range, give us your pitfalls or things that you've seen or things that we really need to be thinking about in terms of nitroglycerin therapy, and then kind of walk us through what we put together in terms of the pathway and initiating. What's the doses we really should be looking at?
So my personal opinion is you need to make sure that you look at the patient in front of you. If this patient is preload dependent, we know that they are going to drop their preload more. So if they're right-sided heart failure, they've had a right-sided MI, or if they're pulmonary and hypertension, of course, if they have aortic stenosis, giving them high dose of nitroglycerin may get you in trouble. They may have a precipitous drop in their blood pressure. The other side of the situation is the patient you described, the patient that is hypertensive. It seems like it's because of their low ejection fraction and they have pulmonary edema, they might benefit from a higher dose of nitroglycerin. So choosing your patient wisely, I think, is the important first step. The next important pearl is don't bother with the IV nitroglycerin if you have some sublingual. You can start that while you're working on getting the IV nitroglycerin.
Okay.
Once you do have an IV established and you have the drip in the room, what I like to start with is about 200 micrograms. I know that that is low compared to the 2 milligram dose that we've seen in the recent study, but you can give more, and you can give more every minute or so until you get a clinical effect, and you can real-time watch the patient's symptoms and repeat their blood pressure frequently. I would also simultaneously start an infusion in that patient. I'd start at the same rate, 1 to 200 micrograms a minute, and make sure you're closely watching that blood pressure because you need to back off as the patient's preload and afterload reduce as you kind of break that sympathomimetic spiral. Mm-hmm. If you will, and you stabilize them, they're not going to require as much preload and afterload reduction. So be in the room, be at the bedside, watch what's going on, make sure your nurses and your team are on board, and then go ahead and adjust your vasoactive medication dose according to the patient's symptoms in front of you.
I like those pearls a lot. So in terms of even before initiating, thinking about that person who's preload dependent, sure, I think we can all check the box on right-sided RVMI. However, in terms of aortic stenosis, being really careful, and then anyone who may be in a preload-dependent state, say those that have increased right-sided pressures, being very careful. And then getting things started. Now, in terms of your sublingual dose, any limit to how many you can give serially?
Not that I'm aware of. However, obviously it depends on the patient in front of you, as well as are they protecting their airway? Are they absorbing the sublingual? Mm-hmm. If they don't have any saliva, they're probably not absorbing that sublingual dose. And so, again, looking at the patient in front of you.
Getting your peripheral IV started and then initiating at 200 micrograms. Correct?
That's where I initiate. I think that there's no wrong answer if you wanted to go a little bit higher, a little bit lower. There's no evidence to say that 200 is the magic number. That's my personal opinion, but that's what I recommend.
And importantly, those are for patients who typically have acute acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema and are hypertensive.
Correct.
Once again, being very careful in someone who's got marginal or lower blood pressure.
I probably would not do the push dose in somebody who's hypotensive, and I would start my drip a little bit more conservatively in those patients as well. You still need that afterload reduction for this pathology. Mm-hmm. However, you may not be able to save the intubation in that patient population.
Outstanding. Well, it's been really, really helpful, Jill. Any additional pearls or thoughts that you have for our listeners?
If you're going to do this in your institution, talk to your pharmacy team, talk to your nursing team, make sure everyone's on board. There's a way to get the medication. There's a way to document the medication has been administered. I know that that sounds silly, but this is a relatively new practice for us here, and those were some of the biggest barriers that we came across.
Yeah, you really did a nice job in putting the clinical protocol together, getting buy-in from a nursing standpoint, provider standpoint, circulating it among lots of folks, citing the literature and saying this is what we feel is the best practice for our patients coming in. I think that was a really nice way to roll out a clinical protocol. And certainly for any of you who are listening who are already on board with using higher dose nitroglycerin or bolus dose nitroglycerin followed by or concurrently with the infusion, and you want to see the protocol that Jill put together, certainly just email us through the website and we'll get that sent over to you. And if you have any questions for Jill, be sure to shoot them also through the website at ccpem.com. Well, thanks again, Jill. That has been really, really helpful. Great, great pearls on something that we use every day for patients coming in with acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema. We will certainly be getting you back on the podcast here to talk about a number of ED and pharmacy-related things as we move through the coming year. So our thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast here on CCPEM. I hope all of you who had a chance to attend the recent resuscitation course in Las Vegas had an outstanding time. Upcoming conferences, certainly be on the lookout for the cardiology symposium that's coming up soon here in Baltimore that was put together and hosted by Dr. Amal Mattu. And then also be on the lookout for the crashing patient dates. Those are coming in the fall, as well as upcoming critical points course. Once again, that's going to be back in San Diego the first weekend in December. I believe it's the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. I'll have to double check. It's that first Friday, Saturday, Sunday in December of 2017. So I think that'll do it for now. Thanks so much again, Jill. And let us know if you have any questions. We will talk to you on the next podcast.